Places, please. Places for the top of Theater Countdown.
Fire! Boom.
That was beautiful. Let's actually keep that and make that the official intro.
I feel like Dr. T.
I don't know. I was getting a little Carol Channing in there.
Oh, sure. She would do that, absolutely. She's a jazz baby after all.
She is
a jazz baby. Blink, blink.
All the blinking. Speaking of Carol Channing, this is Theater Countdown. Right?
Speaking of Carol Channing.
This is the second episode of the second season of Theater Countdown.
Oh, my God. Wait, that was not Carol Channing. That was I was my Patrick Page again.
You're
apparently being
Patrick Page again.
Oh, my gosh. Patrick Page's next one-man show should be Patrick Page is Carol Channing in Welcome Back, Birdie.
Something like that. Carol Channing telling the story of how Marilyn Monroe came to see Gentlemen Prefer Blondes for a month.
And the orchestra was, they just weren't paying attention. She was too beautiful. Except for the one man who said, does she have a brother?
Yeah. The one guy. Just the one.
Just the one.
The one guy. Yeah. At the musical.
Yeah.
At the Broadway musical. The one gay guy.
The one. Should we introduce ourselves? I'm new to
like
this.
To
this is only my second episode.
People didn't know that was a gay joke. Really clear.
That just made me think of the Carol. That was a TikTok that I saw today where she told that story. And then she's like, do I have to explain what I mean by why he wanted to know if she had a brother? And the interviewer was like,
real? No,
Miss Channing, it's a real story. And he was like, no, I think I get it. She's like, are you sure? And he was like, yes.
He's like, I'm interviewing Carol Channing about a Marilyn Monroe musical. I absolutely know what you're talking about.
Pretty sure.
Because
I know
it
how
was
gay
me.
Works.
Yeah. I know how gay works. You go to Tinky Disc, you buy a ticket, you sit down. Hey, the theater's not for gay people.
No, it's for everybody. Right.
We're doing a show.
Except that person is unwrapping candy loudly or texting, in which case, get out of here.
Eject button. So we are. We're back. It's episode 2 of season 2 of your favorite theater-obsessed podcast, Theater Countdown. Wah, wah, wah. I can't make that sound. Wait, how do you make that sound that's like on the radio?
Which sound?
That's the one. Thank you for listening.
Oh, that one. Thank you.
Yeah, I can't make that sound apparently. Mine just comes out sounding more like Carol Channing.
Yeah, I was gonna say yours is just the theater version. It's like pa 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 pa. Like
forgive me.
Oh man.
Yeah, so we're doing a show.
We're
Hi,
doing
Michael,
a
tell
show.
Us all about the show.
Oh my God, this is Theater Countdown, where we
thank God I'm in the right place.
Theater-related topics, and we do our top tens. So currently, we're going through our top 10 favorite flops, Broadway flops.
It's too delicious.
If you missed episode 1, we did our 10 through 6. So today, we'll be doing 5 through 1. But we have a bunch of other things to chat about before that, right?
Yeah,
you can... What?
Buckle your safety belts, everyone, because it gets real fun in the countdown. The top 5 countdown gets real fun in the flop department.
Oh, I can't wait to hear what you chose.
Yeah, but I want to say for your first countdown list, I was very impressed with your list, and I felt like I learned some things.
Oh.
And I look forward to hearing more of your insight.
Oh, thank you very much. And
you're so very welcome. We should start by saying, my friends, that the best way to keep up with us is make sure you're following us on our socials. We're on Instagram. We're on TikTok at Theater Countdown. That's theater with an R-E because we're sophisticated theater goers. You can also watch full episodes on YouTube at youtube.com/countdownnetwork. Of course, we are a proud member of the Countdown Network family. Yes. And I'm always available to you at Ben Does Broadway. And Juddy is at
at M. Judson Berry, hence Juddy, which we've settled on. And you can join us on Patreon if you're very, very obsessed for only $5 a month, which really is not that much. It's just one whole hand, not two. And as we said, like, you can't even go to Starbucks for under $5, but you can join us on Patreon for $5, where we will do virtual hangs. You'll have access to early episodes. There's gifts, I believe. Not gifts as in the ones you send on your phone, but actual things you might enjoy. And private, like, hangouts, correct? That's right?
Yeah, that's what I'm most excited for. You're going to get a bonus episode for each list. We'll do our honorable mentions 15 through 11. And yeah, we're going to get together once a month and, like, face-to-face it in the cyberverse and play some of our stupid fun theater games and get your opinions on all of your countdown lists, which is going to be super awesome. Can you put a price on it? I say no, but we did, and it's $5.
Yes. And speaking of giving your opinions, definitely rate and review us wherever it is you are currently listening to us. We love a good review. Leave us all the ratings. And we were saying we should definitely read out the reviews and in various accents, voices, perhaps made up languages. It's a podcast, so maybe we'll just do charades. Or is your favorite show tune? We'll literally sing it. Yeah. So leave us some fun reviews that we can have some fun with.
I think particularly, I think we should sing the negative reviews because I just think music makes everything a little bit better.
I agree with you. We do a little musical improv moment as far as like.
Oh, do you think I've just inspired people to be nasty?
To leave bad reviews? You did.
Okay. No. We'll sing the good ones and we'll cry through the bad ones.
I'm not very good at crying, though, I gotta say.
You're not, but you're a classically trained actor.
I'll need a tear stick. I know, but I'm not very good at literal. I don't know what it is. I'm not a great crier. And I don't feel so bad about it, because I had a professor once who's, like, the leading lady at the RSC for a very long time, like, their go-to, like, Ophelia, Julia,
RSC,
all that.
What does that mean?
The Royal Shakespeare Company. And she talked about how she's a really bad crier. And she did a production of Hamlet once where they all were on stage the whole time. She'd go right into Ophelia's mad scene. And she was like, I would really sneakily pull, like, she couldn't prep off stage to, like, get herself worked up before the mad scene. She just had to have her back to the audience on stage. And she would sneakily pull a nose hair to start to get the tears going. She's like, sometimes, darlings, all you have to do is cheat just a little bit to get yourself going. Like, I would just pluck a nose out. By the end of the production, I had nothing left in my nose. But here we are.
Effective and tidy.
Yeah, there you go. She probably got a lot of sinus infections after that. You know, they do.
That's how Judi Dench does it.
That's what I've heard. When she's not talking to the trees.
Yeah. Which gives you a very small window.
Yeah, that's true. It's a busy
to catch her plucking her nose hairs. my boyfriend just bought her book. She has a book out now called Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent, Judi Dench. And it's like her deep dive into all of her Shakespeare work and how she approached the characters and her thoughts on the plays and where she's done them. And he said it's amazing and insightful. I'm not an evolved enough human artist to read it as well, but he's reading it and I am supportive of it. It's a beautiful book. It's kind of turquoise, the cover.
Oh, of course it is. Of course
it's
it
gentle.
Is.
Gentle. Yeah.
Well, it's Judi Dench. I love her. I love her and Maggie Smith, too, as far as like a celebrity friendship. I love that they've been best friends for like 300 years. And, absolutely. Yeah.
And they listen, they're old as dirt, and I just could be more fabulous.
Oh,
did you know this? Cats, I just saw this. Cats, the movie, the musical movie of Cats,
yes,
right? Yeah. Didn't Judi Dench play Old Deuteronomy?
She did, and they didn't finish animating it, so it's her human hands, and then the rest of her looks like a cat.
Okay, well, I want to tell you, I have never seen it to this date, and I have to see it, but I'm also like, I know I'm going to be traumatized by the whole thing. But I think I just saw that it's going to be on Netflix soon, so we can just hunker down and watch it on Netflix, which is how I will do it, to see Judi Dench's weird human hands.
That could be a fun Patreon thing, is we could do a cat's watch party.
Oh,
something like that.
Oh, my God. Please.
Yeah. Because confession, I kind of love cats, so I am very much here for that. And Jennifer Hudson belting out Memory.
Oh, and then there was a clip I saw of some guy who was at the Taylor Swift concert who dressed as her character from the Cats movie. And she catches him. She's in the middle of a song. And of course, she's being Taylor Swift. So she's wearing like a druid cloak and like sweeping across a mystical stage. But she catches him and she goes, does a double take, and then looks at him and goes, she does a little kitty paw at him to recognize that. So musical theater is alive and well at the Taylor Swift concert.
That makes me very happy. Shall we move on to some like fun theater news that we were going to chit chat about?
I want to know. I need to know your feelings first, just really quickly. Episode two, how are you feeling?
I'm having the best time. Honestly, this was almost a problem when we were recording the first episode. I forgot that we were making a show and I thought we were just hanging out chit chatting. So we ended up talking for so long.
If you survived episode one, I just want to applaud you because you're a dedicated listener.
Well done. Like, you have to get a new hip halfway through.
Like, oh, well, whatever. I already got mine, so I'm good to go.
Look at you.
I know. Titanic.
But yes, give me any notes as we go, because I know you're the veteran performer.
Oh, so. God, no. I would never note you. But isn't that what the kids say, too? Like, if something's really good, they're like, no notes. Because that's how all kids talk, right? That no notes. Yeah. So if I like your list, I'm going to be like, absolutely no notes.
Ah, my God. That'll be the dream by the end of this. We'll see if you have no notes by the time we reach number one.
Okay. Fair enough.
But if you have notes, go for it.
Yeah. Mine is middle C. All right. Theater news. Very fun for Sweeney Todd. We just saw Josh Groban and Natalie Ashford do their last Dance of Treachery in Sweeney Todd. Both of them fantastic. And, of course, Aaron Tveit and Sutton Foster are going in as Sweeney and Lovett, respectively. But in the interim, and I love this because I think between our last episode and this one, at some point, or very recently, it was like National Swing Day where we're shouting out all the swings and understudies out there.
Yes, which I love. Yeah.
Absolutely. And in the interim, while Tveit and Foster are like getting ready to be in there, they have announced the schedule of the understudies who will be playing Sweeney, Mrs. Lovett, and Pirelli in this like moment in between the star takeover. The guy who plays Pirelli will be stepping in as Sweeney for the evening shows. Another understudy will be doing the matinee shows. Which I just love. And Gina DeWall, who played Diana, who we were talking about the other day, she's playing Mrs. Lovett and Delaney Westfall. And then, of course, because Pirelli is Sweeney, if you can follow this family tree, then Daniel Torres and, oh my gosh, he's a friend of mine. I'm forgetting his name right now. I'm an asshole. Anyway, I think that's so cool. We've got like a week or 2 weeks where you can step in and see these like incredible world-class Broadway veterans whose names you maybe don't know performing these roles. And let's be honest, especially in stunt casting world, I'm not saying this specifically about
Josh and Annalie, not so much Annalie, but.
But I mean, listen, you're getting some people. Sometimes you can get a much better show out of it.
Yeah.
And maybe take the money.
When I saw Sweeney, I saw Nicholas Christopher go on as Sweeney.
Thank
and
you.
He That's was unbelievable. He was so good. I've seen Sweeney many times because I love Sweeney Todd, so I'll see any production of it. And I thought he was perhaps the best Sweeney I've seen. He was so funny. Like, he sings the ever-loving hell out of it, and he's so dark and creepy, but he brought this level of, like, comedy and, like, sort of humanity to him that I hadn't seen before. Usually they play him, you know, very, like, I'm just a murder machine. But he felt so conflicted at the beginning. It didn't seem like he enjoyed killing people. He just wants to kill that one person. And he's just sort of rolling with her. And I don't know. I just loved his whole take. It was so charming. It was so fun to watch. I thought he was phenomenal. So, honestly, this is a great time to go see the show to see him.
Yeah. Power to the understudies.
Yes. And other fun theater news. Well, Suffs is officially coming to Broadway. And a fun thing about that is that Shayna Taub will be in it and is making, continuing to make Broadway history, is only the second woman to star and star the show that she wrote. Oh my God, why was that hard to say? Yeah. She just has so many hyphens. This is the first time since apparently Mickey Grant made Broadway history when she starred in Don't Bother Me, I Can't Cope, which she also wrote, and that was in 1972.
We call it Lin-Manuel Mirandering.
Yeah. So that's very exciting. And then also The Great Gatsby is transferring, and they have officially announced that Jeremy Jordan and Eva Noblezada will be reprising their roles from the Paper Mill Playhouse production. And that starts March 29th at the Broadway Theater.
They're at the Broadway Theater, which means we get Eva Noblezada back at the Broadway Theater where she did Miss Saigon, which was also cool already because the original production of Miss Saigon with Lea Salonga and all the others was also at the Broadway Theater where I saw Miss Saigon 7 times.
Wow. So you like the show?
I love the show. I'm completely obsessed with the show.
Either you love the show or you hate yourself. I can't tell much.
I all of that. And it's so equal that it's very confusing. My therapist is a rich man. I just, from childhood, I have loved Miss Saigon to the point where in Woodshop, we had an opportunity to like silk screen a t-shirt or something. I don't know what that has to do with Woodshop in junior high because I was too afraid to take what I wanted to take, which was home economics and sewing. But I wanted to appear butch, so I took Woodshop. And the best way to appear butch is when it comes time to make your t-shirt, to insist upon making a homemade Miss Saigon t-shirt. The seventh graders loved it. But I'm obsessed. I saw the first production 7 times, and I saw Eva's production probably 3 times.
Wow. I loved it. I first saw Eva's production in London on a date and was absolutely blown away. It was so good. And then not just because the helicopter was so impressive, but then I saw on Broadway twice, I want to say. I loved it. And that was my introduction to Miss Saigon. I knew nothing about it before then, except for like, I think the couple of songs that most people would know.
Right.
Was so good.
Oh, she's so good. She's good in everything. She was amazing in Hadestown, and she's going to be amazing in this.
Yeah.
She's just like a wise spirit. We've spoken to her a couple times on the Broadway cast, which is available whenever you get your podcast as well. She's remarkable. She's like way wise beyond her years, kind of very cool, interesting person. Like sometimes you're talking to her and you can like see her like workout stripper pole behind her, and you're like, okay, great. This woman knows what's up. Okay. Miss Saigon, I love it. I'm obsessed. And now I got stripper pole into the conversation. So I feel pretty good. Let's play a game.
Great.
I want to play.
You want to play. Actually, getting stripper pole into the conversation was the game. You won. You get 16 and a half points. Huzzah.
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 All right. Shall we play a game?
We shall.
Producer Chris is not here today to lead the game, so Producer Danny is filling in, and I'm very excited about this game. It's another new game to Theater Countdown. We play this on Disney Countdown. We've played this on Christmas Countdown. We'll have to come up with a name for this game of some sort. Basically, we're going to be doing overrated, underrated, and perfectly rated using this incredible wheel that we have created. What the wheel is called, I will leave that up to you guys to decide. But basically, we'll do 4 rounds of this, 2 spins each for you guys. And then when the item comes up, you will each talk about whether or not you think it's overrated, underrated, or perfectly rated. All theater-related things. Are you excited?
Beyond.
Always. Yeah.
Okay. Did you not get the hit? Did you not get the message?
We were jazz handing. And then it became something else. And then I went to India for a wedding. And then I took down a couple of light bulbs.
Oh. And I was kind of Spanish.
You were. We were appropriating every culture is what we were doing. Through the power of dance.
And if that doesn't let you know how excited we are, nothing will.
Yes.
And fair enough. My God,
this is a podcast, so most people didn't see it anyway, so it's fine.
Just know that it happened. Also, because it's a podcast, if you can't see, this is a wheel that I like very much. The colors are great, and most importantly, it's got our faces on it.
Yeah,
exactly.
We look like we're on Space Mountain.
Only we were on Space Mountain. That's going to be an episode. We do the whole Broadway Countdown from Space Mountain. It all makes sense.
I love it.
Maybe Donna Murphy will come with us.
I hope
you guys, we have used this wheel on other shows, but you are the first ones to have your faces featured on the wheel. We've just used a very generic one for the other shows, but we are really stepping up the production value here in season 2. Yeah. So
at the risk of not sounding entirely humble, this feels right.
All right. So who wants to spin the unnamed wheel first.
Oh my gosh. I'll do it.
Great, do it.
All right,
Benny.
You're a dancer.
Here we go.
And I'm spinning the wheel. Oh my God. Big money. No whammies. Oh my gosh. Community theater. This, you're speaking my language. Talk dirty to me. Community theater is so near and dear to my heart. Community theater is the most fun you'll ever have doing theater. It's the most important theater that's being done in the world is community theater. It is wildly underrated. I get very upset at people who get very bougie about Broadway or nothing. It's all about community theater. I'm a community theater kid from way back when. Last summer, I was lucky enough to give the keynote address at the American Association of Community Theaters National Conference. So I gave an hour-long speech about my feelings about community theater, which I will not submit you to right now. But
join our Patreon and you can get the whole speech.
Absolutely. Maybe we will. It's in a whole PowerPoint presentation.
I would love that.
Only in community theater would I ever get to play a hoedown dancing golem and explore just how I look in multiple colors of unitards. But community theater is vital to the communities it serves. It changes people's lives. It affects families in a really positive way. It provides a safe space for people who maybe don't feel like they fit in necessarily anywhere else. I don't know if anybody can vibe with that, but I sure as shootin' can. So community theater is underrated. I rate it higher than Broadway. So community theater is king, period, full stop, the end, no notes.
1,000%. 1,000%.
Right?
Love that.
Yes. Oh, no notes. There were no notes on that. Everything you said. Oh, my God.
Community theater is
100%.
King.
It is the backbone. Yes. It is a wonderful, amazing thing. Yes.
I mean, I don't exist if there wasn't community theater. Like, truly.
Same.
Yeah. And I even have friends who've, like, have left New York, super talented people who came here to do theater, and we all get messed up in our heads about what success in theater is. And they go back or they move to wherever they are going to continue the next chapter of their lives and find so much soul fulfillment by getting involved in the community theaters wherever they are. I just can't say enough about it.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Perfect.
I was really lucky.
Have time.
Oh, yeah. Let's go on to the next one. But yes, 1,000%.
Yeah.
Amazing. Underrated. What a great one to start it off with. All right, Juddy,
yeah.
Give us our second spin.
Let's see you spin it. You got to spin it. Ugh. Have you been working out? That was a really strong spin. Speaking of notes.
Fellow cast members giving you notes. Ooh. Oh my God. I remember the first time someone tried to do that to me. This is what were the underrated, overrated, or perfectly rated? No, don't do that. Like, this is just never give. Like, I the fury that's like burning in me right now. Just I remember I went into I was on the road in a tour, and I joined it. It was the second year it was on the road, and only part of the cast stayed, and like, but I was one of the new ones. And I remember the first week of rehearsals, everyone who had already been in it came up to tell me everything that the guy before me did. And how, like, anything I did differently, like, they were like, no, but he did it like this. Oh, no, but he did it like that. And it made me insane. I was like, I am not him. I don't know where you rate that as far, like, my rating was just don't do it. It's infuriating. You're... Like, unless somebody specifically is like, would you mind helping me out on this? Like, I do remember I was in a show once where we had to do a lot of really heavy accent work, and it was British. I did Curious Incident, and I had to do 9 characters with 9 different British accents. And there was somebody who was very good at English accents. And I was like, please give me, like, help me. Listen to me and help me. So if somebody, but unsolicited notes from a cast member, just don't do it. So overrated? I don't know. Yeah, get out of town.
Well, I think if later on in the episode, I think I may have a story about somebody who gave notes where they shouldn't have been and took an entire show down with it. So stay tuned for that.
Well, I mean, isn't there a famous story about Patti LuPone with that when she did Evita? And they all were like, well, Elaine Page did it like this in London. She did it like that. And Patti LuPone finally had to be like, I'm not Elaine Page and I will play this role how I want. And yeah, it was a big thing. Yeah.
Don't
it went well. She did a good job, I hear. So.
Yeah, as Evita?
Yeah.
Yeah. She's all right.
It's sort of how I feel being game master today and taking over for Chris. I am not Chris, and I'm going to do these games the way that I would like to do them. So,
you know, good for you.
If Chris was doing this, he would look like he was in the hull of a spaceship. I'm just saying.
That's true.
Instead, I went for my dining room with all of my wife's collection of wine bottles behind me. So, you know, very similar.
She's got good taste.
Yep. She does have good taste. All right, let's move on to the third one. Give it a spin, Benny.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
If there was ever a subject matter that we are like really gunning for a sponsorship deal, it's with TKTS, because I feel like we've talked about TKTS in both episodes a lot. TKTS also underrated, couldn't rate it high enough. TKTS is the place to be. And also, like, get uptown to TKTS. Go uptown where there's no lines. You don't have to stand outside in the cold. You can still get your half price tickets up near Lincoln Center. So don't forget that when you're in town, people. It's just a quick ride up the one train.
63rd and Broadway.
Yeah, get yourself there. TKTS is magic in Times Square, and it's iconic, and it is, you can get, that's really kind of the best deal, because some of the other places where you would go to get like a cheap ticket when you don't have to like be there in person, you're getting hit up with a lot of fees as well. So I'm just saying. TKTS is underrated. Kick it up the ladder a couple notches, friends. TKTS
1,000%.
How many times? It'd be interesting if I could like put on a life clock, which I guess would be right here. How many minutes I've spent in line at TKTS in my history of humanity?
That would probably be a lot of minutes. Insane.
Bunches.
I did work there. A lot of those minutes I was getting paid to be there. But but it's great, as you said. It's good because you're supporting a nonprofit. And yeah, you don't get hit with the fees that you do with all those online ones. And you get to actually choose your seat. As opposed to a lot of them, it's a real crapshoot as to where you're going to sit.
That's a total crapshoot.
So at least this way, like, you know where you're sitting and you know what you're getting into.
And you're not like divvying up like this section. If you want to do the crapshoot, it's going to be a vastly different price from one to the, anyway. Yeah.
Wonderful. We did it.
Wonderful.
So underrated. Fantastic.
Underrated.
All right. Last one for this episode. Over to you, Jenny.
Oh my gosh. Spin true, my friend. Spin true.
God, speaking of discounted theater tickets, ticket lotteries. Oh, the lotteries. I don't know. I think they're perfectly rated. I think people utilize them quite a bit, and the people that use them appreciate them when they win. And they're great. I love a ticket lottery. I think it's awesome. I famously have terrible luck with ticket lotteries. I so rarely win them, but I hope springs and I enter and I try. And usually they're great seats for great prices. I just think they used to be so much cheaper, and I wish they've got, like anything else, you know, inflation. I remember when it was like, you know, what, $15, $10 for your ticket. Now it's like $55 and you're like, is that really that big of a discount? But like, ticket lotteries, can we lump that in with rushing? Like, because I remember the one time I rushed once the musical, and I was that person who got there at like 4 o'clock in the morning and like hunkered down in front of the theater because my boyfriend at the time really wanted to see it. We both were broke actors, and it was the only way we could afford to go. And I brought like a piece of cardboard to sit on the sidewalk, and it was freezing rain. The weather was horrible, but it was like a trauma bonding experience with me and the other people in line, and still got the tickets. It was great. It was so worth it. It was, but then I was like, I'm never doing this again.
There's something fun about the ticket lottery too, especially if it's an in-person ticket lottery where you're all kind of there and you get a button if you win, like at Wicked, you get like the I won the Wicked lottery button that you can parade around town in, and that feels good. It feels gives you a rush of adrenaline. Because a lot of the lotteries too now you can do online as well. But if you want that real zing, that real thrill, you got to be in person. Hey, can I just talk, since we're talking about ticket prices, can I tell you, when I was researching for last week's episode and I was getting into all that Raggedy Ann stuff, that I watched like a news clip of a review of Raggedy Ann, which of course was like, oh, by the time they get you at the second act, it's way too late. But at the end of that review, so what was that, 1986, I think we said, was Raggedy Ann on Broadway? Sure. They said, and Raggedy Ann, playing on Broadway at the Hoosie Wussy Theater, has a top ticket price of $40. Top ticket price, wow. $40. Whew, man.
It's definitely a pre-Hamilton show.
That is pre-producer show, like,
oof.
Yeah, $40 will get you, well, maybe a lottery ticket.
Maybe a lottery ticket if you're lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yes, but lotteries, thumbs up, perfectly rated.
Yeah. I think this wheel is called the Wonder Wheel.
Yeah.
The Wonder Wheel? Okay. Yeah. I'm fine with it being, I think we called it something similar on Christmas Countdown, like the Winter Wonder Wheel or something like that. So maybe there's something like theater specific that we can throw in there. That's an alliteration that starts with a W. I'll leave that up to you guys to figure out.
Show on the verge of a wonder wheel.
The showbiz spinner.
The showbiz spinner?
The showbiz spinner.
Welcome to the showbiz spinner.
Blink, blink. Well, it's a terrific wheel that you can spin.
It's just terrific, Mama. Have you spun the showbiz wheel, Mama?
You know what we should do?
It's so many colors.
You know what we can do is on Spotify, we can put polls in. And so we could ask people if they think Showbiz Spinner should be the name of this wheel. And they can vote yes or no. And whatever takes the majority will decide.
Cool. Absolutely. Name the wheel.
Love
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Love
well,
that.
Thanks for letting me come in and play with you guys today. This has been a blast.
Thanks, Danny.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh, I'm spent from that game. I love that. This could be the whole show for me is playing that game.
Probably. To quote Gwyneth Paltrow, that wasn't just the bee's knees. That was the whole bee's leg.
When on earth did Gwyneth Paltrow say that? And what was actually the context?
From when she was on SNL, she was in a sketch and she played this ridiculous character that just said things like that. And for whatever reason, it stuck with me. You're welcome. That has nothing to do with the game, but that was super fun.
Well, look, I have a bee right here.
Ah, you even do have a bee. Look at that. It was all meant to be.
Save the bee, save the world, right?
For real. We love bees.
It's a pin, but I lost the back.
Oh, no.
So now it's a tchotchke.
Now it's just a weapon, really, if somebody tries to break it. If some crazed Audrey McDonald fan comes trying to find you.
Comes to my apartment seeking Audra. Do not come to my apartment seeking Audra McDonald. You will not find her New York library. She is not here. All right. Let's talk flops.
Let's do it.
Flop talk.
Flop talk. Gosh.
Flop talk. Welcome to flop talk.
Welcome to flop talk.
Flop talk. Now it sounds like Hungarian. Welcome to flop talk.
Where we discuss the flops.
The flop. All the flops that are flipped to flop.
Exactly. Not about pancakes.
That's a flap.
No, but one day we could talk about our favorite flop houses.
Yeah. But I like to talk about flapjacks.
Hey, I named my first
Let's
child flapjack.
Some flapjacks.
This.
It's a gymnastics theater breakfast pastry podcast.
Flips,
flops, and flapjacks.
Sign me up for that. That sounds like a great day.
Can someone let us know if that's a Hungarian accent, like even in the sphere?
We're
kind of being Eastern Bloc, aren't we?
Yeah, we're sort of like, where are you from? I don't know.
Like Julia Garner in that show. Okay, great.
And yes, so flop.
So pull it together, men. Here we go.
Should we recap real quick our shows from
last time for
episode?
A red hot recap, I think.
Great.
Do you want to start us off with your...
I'll start us up? off because I'll admit that I've already messed up. So, friends, I had this as a Word document, my top choices, and then I was sort of deleting as we went because, if you remember, I was changing my mind as we went. So I went to recap and I realized I deleted all the shows I talked about last week. So, but as I can recall, it was, my number 10 was a tie between two Angela Lansbury shows, Dear World and Anyone Can Whistle. And then it was the Britney Spears musical, Once Upon a One More Time. It was the Sting vehicle, The Last Ship. the black and white Jen Colella moment, Chaplin. And then the amazing camp classic Diana the musical, available on Netflix.
So solid.
But if I got that wrong, please let us know in the comments.
All of that had a very familiar ring. I think that's right.
Yeah, I know those are the ones I discussed. I'm just only 80% sure that was the order in which I discussed them.
They'll let us know, won't
yes,
you?
Yes, they will. Please do.
All right, strong. All right, I'm going to do my 10 through 6. So I started out with Smile by Marvin Hamlisch and Howard Ashman. It was my number 10. My number 9 was that freaky deaky Raggedy Ann musical from 1986.
Terrifying.
That was on Broadway. How does that happen? Number 8 was Glory Days, open and closed in the same night. Number 7 was Wonderland, which apparently I have a lot of rage issues towards, so I'll be seeing my therapist about that. Good. And my number 6 was It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman, which they hauled a Superman around the stage on a rope clunkily.
So slowly.
And called it and Harold Prince directed it.
Yeah.
Okay. Those were my 10 through 6 flops. Let's get into a top 5. My heart is beating fast. I'm so excited.
Let's do it.
Juddy, I number 5 to you, my friend. Get
All
us
right.
in there.
So, this I chose because, so when I think of Broadway flops, I think of Joe Allen's, the restaurant on 46th Street.
Yeah, we extrapolate on that.
Yeah, we briefly touched on it. So I love Joe Allen's. It's one of my go-to pre-show spots. It's a big like Broadway hangout. Victor Garber flirted with me once at the bar. It was a very exciting moment
Wait,
for me.
Wait, is Victor Garber gay?
I believe so. Yeah.
I just never knew. I never thought about Victor Garber's sexual preference.
Yeah. Well, actually, and again, this isn't fair. He might not have been hitting on me. He might have just been asking me to move away from him. And I just interpret it as I chose. Because I'm such a big fan. He might have said, sir, could you please move out of the way so I can order? And I was like, oh my God. Anyway, I digress. So at Joe Allen's, though, a fun thing is that if your show flops, you go up on the wall, sort of like like a badge of honor. So when you eat, you're surrounded by like all the biggest Broadway flops. And the one that whenever I eat there, I almost always end up sitting underneath the poster for Breakfast at Tiffany's, the musical.
Oh my
so
God,
that
yeah.
is why that is number 5, because that usually is one that like pops right into my head. I can see the poster. It's bright yellow and it's based on the film Breakfast at Tiffany's. It starred Mary Tyler Moore. So this, another one of those shows that had an amazing group around it, right? So Bob Merrill wrote the music. Edward Albee wrote the book. After they did out-of-town tryouts and they didn't like the book, so they fired the original writer and brought in Edward Albee, which seems like a very strange choice to write a musical. David Merrick produced it, who's like one of the greatest Broadway producers of all time. So it was this incredible group of people that just could not get the show together. So it moved to Broadway. It started previews December 12th, 1966. And it closed before it could even open. So they did previews and then, they never actually opened.
They had an opening night.
So David Merrick told the New York Times, announcing the shutdown before it even started, he said, rather than subject the drama critics and the public to an excruciatingly boring evening. apparently when it was off Broadway, or when it was in its Boston trial, it had times where it was 4 hours long and the cast was getting new rewrites every single day. The whole thing was just a mess.
Dude.
And it just never came to fruition, which I didn't realize what a flop it was until I Googled this, because I just knew the poster and I was like, how did that not go anywhere? Yeah, literally never opened.
Because on paper, it seems like a no-brainer. Like, the Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah. How do you make it 4 hours long? I mean, even the movie isn't 4 hours long. And it's based on a novella. It's not even a full novel.
Like, really? Well, songs, I guess, for one. But that's too, that's when you, this seems like too many people unwilling to compromise. It seems like the collaboration was not on point here.
Yeah. And like, apparently poor Mary Tyler Moore was just like a wreck the entire time. She had a thing saying that like every day she thought she was going to get fired.
Oh my God.
It was like, yeah, apparently nobody had a good time working on this Breakfast at Tiffany's production.
Oh my God. That is so wild to me. Mary Tyler Moore?
Yeah. Like, and she probably was fantastic.
I mean, she's got the most charm of any person that you've ever heard of in your entire life.
For real.
That is absolutely.
I know, it's bonkers. Choreography by Michael Kidd, who, as I recall, was like another, like, did Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, you know, won 5 Tony Awards. Like, it's just everything should have added up to an amazing show, but you're probably right. It's just a too many cooks.
Oh my gosh. All right. Well, she had a good run of it. Outside of that, Mary Tyler Moore.
She did okay.
She did all right, if you like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which apparently, the Breakfast and Tiffany's, they didn't. I said, what about Breakfast
at Tiffany's? And they said we will not open the show. Anyway, we'll work on that.
we'll workshop it. All right.
Yeah.
Learning. My number 5, top flop. And this is fun because this show flopped not once, but twice.
Oh, no.
And weirdly flopped harder on the revival than it flopped famously in the first. And it's a big cult hit and people love it. And I am people. I love it. My number 5 is Sideshow. Sideshow.
Okay.
1997, Alice Ripley, Emily Skinner. It's about Siamese twins, so they had to do the entire show with their hips stuck together, holding hands. Like, there was no actual physical device keeping their bodies together. They had to, like, rehearse till they, like, walked around with their hips stuck to each other. Mm-hmm. But that ran for 97 performances in 1997. And I know we talk about your history at the TKTS booth, and I remember when I went to see it in 1997, he says, while showing off his glorious skin.
I loved it.
It was completely insane. And I love bombast. And this is a bombastic production.
Uh-huh.
And I remember seeing Alice Ripley and Emily Skinner standing outside TKTS, like barking and trying to get people to come see the show because they knew they were in trouble at the box office. And so they were hitting the streets. The two stars of the show before they would go on stage were on the streets essentially begging people to come see their show because they loved it, they believed in it, and they were amazing together. But 91 performances, and I think part of the problem there was that the marketing was weird. People didn't know what to make of it. Like, Sideshow, what is this? And the marketing was really dark. Like, it was like grainy black and white photo and then like a banner. So you couldn't really tell what it was or what the tone was. So they really addressed that in 2014 when they did the revival and brought in Bill Condon. Is that right? See a famous
Maybe.
Bob.
That sounds right.
Bob Condon. Anyway, he's a famous like movie director guy. And he took the helm and like made it this glorious kind of razzle dazzle, gorgeous marketing plan. And they changed up the script, changed up some of the music. The core of the music that we all loved was there. Mm-hmm. And that ran for only 56 performances.
Wow.
And I remember seeing it being like, oh, they did it. Sideshow is here. It was just ahead of its time. This is the way it should be presented. This is the product. And that starred Aaron Davey.
Aaron Davey again. Yeah.
Aaron Davey's back in play. And Emily Padgett, mm-hmm. whom I adore. And that ran for 56 performances. I thought they had really kind of fixed the production. But the songs have become iconic. Everybody knows and loves the big duets, Who Will Love Me As I Am, and I Will Never Leave You.
Yeah.
But what I want to play for us right now, because this is a song that was in the 97 production that did not make it into the 2014 revival. There was one scene where the girls and their love interests, so of course the girls are sitting in the middle because they're attached at the hip.
Yeah.
And then they have love interests, and they're sitting there, and they go in the carnival. They go into like the tunnel of love, and it was them sitting in this car with a big like neon heart around them, and they were just kind of parked in the middle of the stage, but like up to 8 feet in the air.
Okay.
And they just sat there with this thing blinking, so it was supposed to look like you're going to the tunnel, and have the most outrageous knockdown, drag out, over the top quartet about love and loss and who's diddling who in the tunnel of love and who's not getting any. And
wow. It is
absolutely bonkers, and it's aptly titled Tunnel of Love, and this is what it sounded like. Forget it. Leave it to Alice Ripley to like give you like a throaty, desperate belt. I was so sad when that didn't make it in there, but I love Sideshow so much. And they tried it twice and flippity, floppity, flapjacky.
Yeah, I missed both productions. But yes, I do love. There are a couple of
well,
those songs
then you're
that
the
are
problem.
Just like, I know. Well, to be fair, I was not in the country during the revival. Otherwise, I would have seen it. I did listen to the soundtrack. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I was ready for you to say something crazy like, well, I wasn't born in 1997.
Yeah, I'm not that young. I was very much alive in 1997. Where was I in 1997, though? I was 10 years old.
Oh, my God.
I was seeing Victor Victoria. That's what I was doing.
Oh, for sure.
Because I went for my 10th birthday, and it was my first ever Broadway show was Victor Victoria.
And you saw Julie Andrews?
I saw Julie Andrews the month before she had her surgery.
And lost her voice forever. And then they put Liza into Victor Victoria.
Oh my God.
And the backstage stories I have heard about Liza Minnelli during Victor Victoria will shake you to your core.
Yeah.
Just like having people with like pre-lit cigarettes for her, like on stage, like when she had to run behind a set piece, she needed a cigarette and like doing lines. And
what?
Liza. Like full tilt boogie Liza.
Oh,
and not remembering her lines. And oh, God, I wish I'd seen that.
Oh, man. Someone needs to make a movie about that called like Liza with a V. Well, two V's. I don't know. There's something there.
Liza with two V's. I love it. Liza with two V's, not Liza with a Z. Oh, there's a song in there.
There is.
We're creating original material songs for each and
Liza
every
Liza. Yeah, I liked Victor Victoria. That was my uncle, the one who took my friend to see Riverdance, was very confused when he was like, it's your 10th birthday, come to New York, I'll take you to any Broadway show you want. And, like, Music Man was on, Bring It to Noise, Bring It to Funk was on, and I was a tapper. And so he was like, for sure, he'll want to see that. Nope, Victor Victoria, because Mary Poppins was my favorite movie and I loved Julie Andrews. I knew nothing about Victor Victoria. I just knew Mary Poppins was on Broadway and I needed to see her. And
did you like Victor Victoria?
I loved it. Because also I loved old movies and old slapstick humor. And that whole movie is just total slamming doors comedy because it's Blake Edwards, who directed the Pink Panther movies and the movie version. And I thought it was amazing. And my uncle was dating a dancer at the time who knew like half the ensemble. So they got me backstage. And so, I mean, and how cool for your first Broadway show if you're like a 10-year-old musical theater kid, like went backstage. And Rachel York was out that night, but this woman, Tara O'Brien, was in for Norma Cassidy. And she was amazing. And she thought I was so cute. So she took me around and introduced me to the whole cast and took me on stage. And they like taught me part of the choreography on the stage. The only person I didn't get to meet, sadly, was Julie Andrews, because she had just come back from vocal rest of like a break that night, and she was doing a press conference because she was going in for the surgery soon after. And so she was doing a press conference that night after the show. So she had all these people backstage interviewing her. So she was the only one I didn't get to meet. But Michael Nouri, Tony Roberts, and they all were so sweet. It was like one of those truly like magical experiences.
Oh my gosh. I must have been like 12 or 13, and I went to Las Vegas and we saw Starlight Express when it was at the Hilton there. And somehow my mother's friend knew somebody. My mother's friend was related to some guy in the cast. And so they were trying to like hook it up so I could go backstage. And I just became so insecure about it. I'm looking, they're like, yeah, here's this picture in the program, because we bought the big fancy souvenir program, and I refused to go back. I couldn't handle it.
Oh.
Couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. I don't know where. I must have just been on cloud nine. I am just oh my God. Anyway, back
That's
to
a dream
so.
Come true.
Oh, it was amazing. So now we're on to number four.
Four. Intensity builds.
My fourth one, this is because of my love of two big Broadway leading ladies, Christine Baranski and Joanna Gleason. So okay. This is okay. Nick and Nora, the musical, okay. Which great. I did not see as well. It opened on Broadway in 1991. It was written by, the book is by Arthur Lawrence, who wrote Gypsy, among many other wonderful things. Music by Charles Strauss, who we mentioned before, who wrote Annie, mm-hmm. among many other wonderful things. So Nick and Nora is based on the Thin Man series. So there was a book called The Thin Man, and then a whole lot of movie versions, and there was a radio version, TV versions, all very big during like the 1930s and 40s.
Okay.
The movies especially, starring Myrna Loy and... who did she star opposite? They were one of the most famous sort of like duos who made movies in the 1940s. William Powell. If you're an old movie buff, William Powell and Myrna Loy did the films, and they were very famous for playing these characters, Nick and Nora, who are a married couple who are very snarky, and then they like solve murders in that very sort of like 1940s kind of way, where they're like, oh, Nick, stop being a heel, you know, that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So they made a musical version starring Joanna Gleason as Nora, and let me see who is Barry Bostwick was Nick. And then the cast also included Christine Baranski, Deborah Monk, Faith Prince, and Chris Sarandon.
Shut up.
Uh-huh.
Wow, that's stacked.
Right? It ended up getting nominated for a Tony for Best Score, but sadly it did not run for very long. I can't remember how many performances it actually ran, maybe like 15. The problem they said with this was they decided to not do an out-of-town tryout. Instead, they just did 71 previews in New York. And they said they think, according to like producers, the problem they thought was that they were constantly doing rewrites throughout, and New York audiences and New York theater people like were all seeing it. And so by the time it opened, a lot of people had already seen versions that they didn't like. So there was a lot of very negative press around it. So when it opened to like already people had decided they didn't like it. So a problem with running in New York for too long before you're ready.
Which never happens.
Yeah, that's what I was so like, what rare. An interesting choice that they were like, they were supposed to do an out-of-town trial in Baltimore, and then they were like, ah, screw it, we'll just do 9 weeks of previews in New York.
Wow.
Yeah.
You and know, they did that with, do you remember they did that with School of Rock, where they did that, they did the show, rather do any sort of out-of-town, they did the show down at the Gramercy Theater, like downtown, like 14th Street or below 14th Street, way on the east side, which is this like crazy old little theater, and they just did like an off-Broadway tryout of the show with Alex Brightman and all the people and all the kids, and so we're like, okay, great, good, now we're good. Then they did it for like 3 weeks or something. Maybe I'm wrong about that. And then opened it on Broadway, and that worked out.
Wow.
But you just never hear about that.
That one did a little bit better. Yeah. No, you really don't hear about that. Sorry. Now I just found it. Nick and Nora. It says after bad publicity because of the rumors during previews and then brutal reviews, it ran for 9 performances.
9 performances.
But it gave us this kind of amazing song called Everybody Wants to Do a Musical, which Christine Baranski thinks her character is Tracy Gardner. And like, we did play it now, but she does like a little bit of an intro to it, which is just so wonderfully Christine Baranski. And it makes me sad that it didn't run longer, because I bet she was just amazing. And she's like, am I losing my mind? And she sings incredibly high, which I did not know she was physically capable of doing. But yeah.
No. But is it the opening of the show?
It's the second song. The opening of the show is called Is There Anything Better Than Dancing? That's the name of the song.
Wait, so the first two songs are called Is There Anything Better Than Dancing? And the second one is what?
Everybody Wants to Do a Musical. And the best is, wait till you go, but this is my impression of her. Everybody wants to do a musical, even me. Like, but she says musical. Oh, it's great. It's great.
Christine Baranski, hands up to Christine Baranski, who has had this like legendary career, basically just being Christine Baranski.
Essentially, yeah. And now you that know? She's on the Gilded Age, she's slowly just becoming our answer to Maggie Smith.
Like 100%.
I feel like she's watching Maggie Smith's career and she's like, I can do that.
Yeah, this seems good. Yeah. Which is great because when they do the remakes of the Harry Potter films in another 10 to 20, she's ready to be Professor McGonagall.
Perfect.
Are we listening to that song? Let's listen to that song.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to do a musical, even me. That's the way I'll be a movie star. My career is near dead end. Always cast as someone's friend. Found a vocal coach who took me far. And he said I had the biggest range he'd ever had to do a musical. E to C.
I love her so much. I would listen to Christine Baranski read the phone book or a kind of terrible song from Nick and Nora, which I have sung along to many times in my car.
Or anything at all, really.
Truly.
All right.
Your turn.
Number four. This is going to be the first crossover on our list because for my number four, I have chosen Anyone Can Whistle.
Oh, nice. Okay, so we can go into more depth now.
Anyone Can Whistle, which ran 9 performances.
Okay.
Is all it did. But the thing about Anyone Can Whistle is... And I kind of, with any Sondheim show that has flopped, there's just, it's stacked with these songs that we kind of live on forever from a show that no one really cared about. Like Everybody Says Don't, the title song, Anyone Can Whistle, is one of the most beautiful songs ever written.
Yeah.
Quite honestly, it's absolutely stunning. I used to write an article for Classical Singer magazine about like show tune rep. And I've like written essays about the song Anyone Can Whistle and why it's so perfect and every singer should dive into it. Mm-hmm. But there's just so much great music. And I mean, Angela Lansbury, Madeline Kahn, yes?
Wait, was Madeline Kahn in that?
I'm out of my mind right now. Is that true?
I will double check for you real quick. Oh my God, Madeline Kahn. Talk about another person who I would listen to read the phone book.
Arthur Lawrence again. We can't get rid of Arthur Lawrence. He's a part of everything from a certain time to another certain time.
Yeah.
Or maybe she just did the Carnegie Hall thing. It's going to be what I'm thinking.
Audra McDonald did it. Betty LaPone. Yeah. Madeline Kahn. You're right. Wait.
Yeah.
There was a cut song. Oh no. You're right. She did the concert.
Oh, okay. Well,
in 1995 with the Gay Men's Chorus and Angela Lansbury.
Yeah, it's a weird little show about a mental hospital and a city and them trying to get out. But it's just so bizarre, but it has such incredible music that just gets done in concerts all the time and is kind of fascinating enough to just keep our attention all these years later. Let's see, what year was this? Did you remember what year that was?
Oh, I just closed out of the window. Hold on.
Oh, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. You've got Google. You guys can look it up.
1964.
1964. Come on.
Wow. What a year for Broadway that was, too.
Yeah. I want to delight our senses with a little Bernadette singing a song from that. Neither of the two songs that I've already brought up, but there's a song in there that's so powerful called There Won't Be Trumpets. And I heard Bernadette Peters do this at her Carnegie Hall concert that was recorded. I was there in 1996 in the audience. I just moved to New York City and was on a date with a girl.
How'd that go?
This is a story. We're not together. It's really weird. But this song is so, you know, Bernadette singing Sondheim is amazing. But just listen to this. And why did this show not run?
Yeah.
The power of it all. The power. It's just so exciting.
I love that. Wallaby
trumpet. She just repeats herself three times and belts the roof off of Carnegie Hall. All right, number three. What
you
got?
Tits out.
That's how I live my life.
So my my number three, this is another, this is one that I did see, and this is my number three because it has real sentimental value for me. Good Vibrations, the Beach Boys musical.
You did see it?
I saw it, which opened in 2005. My dad and
I went
and saw it.
I bet you listening didn't know that that existed.
Yeah, most people have never heard of Good Vibrations because I think it opened, I believe, the same year as Jersey Boys. And so it was like up against like the jukebox juggernaut that was Jersey Boys. But this was early days. Like a lot of jukebox musicals weren't popular yet. Like we had only had Mamma Mia. And then Jersey Boys, I feel like, was really what did it, right? Like, since Jersey Boys, every year we have a jukebox musical.
Oh, but, for sure.
But I think people were very critical of them at the time. Because the main complaint, so Good Vibrations is the Beach Boys musical. It opened in 2005. Obviously, music by Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, a book by Richard Dresser. It featured a very young Titus Burgess.
Titus Burgess. That was his Broadway debut.
Yep, and Krista Rodriguez was in it. Made her Broadway debut in that, which I did not know until I was looking this up. It received very mixed reviews. Mostly the issue that people had was that, like, the plot was ridiculous, right? It was about, like, a group of young guys who are, like, the cool kids who graduate from school and they're going to move to California, but they don't have a car. And so they need, like, the cool, the nerdy chick to, like, bring them across. And, like, the shenanigans that happen. And then once they get to California, they realize they're not as cool as they thought. Like, it's a shoestring plot, but I remember it was fun, but the big thing I saw with my dad, who, like, my dad, when he was young, was in rock and roll bands, and played a lot of Beach Boys when he was, like, in his first, like, cover band when he was in high school and college. And so, like, I grew up listening to the Beach Boys because he loves them so much, because he played so much of their music. And so, like, we were in New York, and we were like, oh, let's see a show, went to TKTS, and he was like, the Beach Boys, this will be great. And, like, that was one where I couldn't tell you really what the show was about, but I just know that my dad had the best time. And I think that's sometimes the power of some of these shows. Like, does it have to be like a Pulitzer Prize winning show? No. But like, is that one of the best memories I have with my father? Yes. Because like, that was perhaps the most fun I've ever seen him have at a show. Because he likes theater, like he enjoys it, but he's not a huge theater buff. And his big thing with theater, when he sees a show, because he's like, my life is stressful, my job is stressful. When I go to the theater, I want to be able to just switch my brain off and have a good time. So I'm pretty sure to this day, his favorite shows he ever saw were, it was Good Vibrations and then After Midnight. Because After Midnight had no talking, it was just great music and dancing. So. Yeah. So Good Vibrations will always have a special place in my heart. And watching him like mouth along to the words, which he's never done before, like you could see him bring him right back to when he was 16 playing rock and roll.
You see this too with certain shows that come out, whether they're new or jukeboxy. There, you feel like they're really going for the dad audience. Like, we gotta get the one that the dads are gonna be like, I'll go see that show.
Yeah,
and I think there's a lot of people, tourists that come to New York City, or you know, a lot of people who don't know anything about theater at all, exactly like you said, just want. I mean, there's a lot of power in just the music, the dancing, the lights, the color.
Yeah. And the nostalgia of something this, you see now why these jukebox musicals are, like, I finally just saw the Neil Diamond musical. And, that audience, too. You can see they're all singing along. And, like, it's for a specific audience, and they love it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but why does one work, and why does another one not work?
That's the thing. Like, that year, we had Jersey Boys, and we had Good Vibrations. Why was one better? Maybe because Jersey Boys was about him, and this was, like, in theory, an original story, not about the actual Beach Boys, who knows?
Mm-hmm. That's a whole topic of discussion, right? Like the jukebox musicals that impose stories upon them and the ones that are about the artists you're singing about.
And I wonder now if we would be so critical, because the critics say, you know, they were like, well, the songs didn't really move the plot because they're just sort of like shoehorning these songs in there because they're hits. But I feel like we've now seen that happen so many times. They might be like, well, like, yeah. It works.
It's not going anywhere, yeah. Or like, I guess so, they pulled it off.
Yeah, but
it
was fun.
It made it make sense somehow.
It made us want to, you know, dance, 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 or, you know, till they took the T-Bird away, or however that one went. It gave us good vibrations.
They're giving really out good vibrations.
Vibrations. And the excitation. I actually just listened. I was in Australia a couple weeks ago, and we were driving to the beach, and I'm a real cheese ball. Mm-hmm. So I was like, what do we listen to when we're driving to the beach? So we put on the Beach Boys.
Obviously.
It put me in the mood.
Yeah.
Excitation. It also gave us the word excitation.
It gave us excitations. Yeah, even I was looking to see on their Wikipedia if it says just how many performances they had, and it's a real slim Wikipedia page. So if that tells you anything, oh no, there we are. 94 performances.
Oh, okay.
So not a total, but still.
3 months ish. Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Something.
All right.
Moving right along.
We're getting to the deep end of the pool here on this side. We're number three, right?
You're number three, yes.
My number three. Okay. Let me take a deep breath.
Okay.
My number three flop ran for 68 performances in 1988, and we're still trying to get this musical right. It's Chess.
Oh, my God.
Chess is number three. Chess is legendary.
People won't let that musical go. Yeah.
We won't let it go until we beat it into submission somehow. Chess, I grew up on the Broadway cast album from the time I was very young. I was obsessed. I was also recently in Bangkok. So, of course, I listened to One Night in Bangkok on a tuk-tuk ride.
Yeah.
All right. So Chess is the love child of Tim Rice, who, you know, did everything with Andrew Lloyd Webber and Elton John and the guys from ABBA. And this was before they went into Mamma Mia territory. Mm-hmm. So 1988, it started with a really popular concept album, right? So they had this concept album, which kind of sprung these radio hits of I Know Him So Well and One Night in Bangkok. Did you know I Know Him So Well? Whitney Houston and her mother covered that on one of her albums.
No. Oh, I'll have to go find this.
Sissy Houston and Whitney Houston sing I Know Him So Well on one of her albums. I don't know which one it is. Maybe it's the one where she's like, I was about to say smiling, but that's not going to narrow it down.
Really.
She's smiling on the cover, but maybe it will.
It's the one where she had hair, you know, that.
Yeah, like, she had hair and her eyes. She had eyes.
She had eyes, yeah. I remember
you know
that
the one.
Yeah.
But here's the delicious tea on Chess. So I think it ran for like 3 years-ish in the UK when they opened it, and then they brought it to Broadway, and of course it just fell apart. But it starred Judy Kuhn, who was like the goddess of musicals in the 80s. She's the voice of Pocahontas. She's still getting Tony nominated to this day for shows like Fun Home, and she was in Fiddler, and I just worship the ground she walks on. She was in the original Cosette in Les Mis.
That's right.
But it gave us Judy Kuhn on a really big level, and it all just sounds like ABBA goodness. But it was Tim Rice's idea originally. He wanted to do a musical about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh,
at some
does.
Point,
yeah,
naturally. So he had this idea, and he wanted to do it with Andrew Lloyd Webber because they were already working together, and that never happened. But he still wanted to do some musical that had to do with the Cold War.
Okay.
So then he was like, oh, well, there was a whole mania around Bobby Fischer and the Russian guy, and it was like the Battle of the Chess Masters, and it was just a really, really big worldwide news sensation. So then he took his inspirations, like, I'm doing my Cold War musical, and it's going to be about the chess, which it's going to be a metaphor for the Cold War.
Smart, actually, when you think about it. That's a great idea.
Sure. And he went to Andrew Lloyd Webber with it, and Andrew Lloyd Webber was already too knee-deep in... What would he have been knee-deep in?
Wait, this is 1981?
1988.
Phantom opened in 87, I believe. So it would have been whatever he did right after Phantom. Or he was just like promoting Phantom.
There was something. So then like some agents and managers got involved with Tim Rice. And they're like, you know what? The guys from ABBA are really looking to expand and do music outside of ABBA. So they got together and it clicked and they came up with Chess. And the music is absolutely stunning. And they have since then been trying to figure it out. They do it in concert with people like Idina Menzel and Josh Groban and Adam Pascal. And they keep trying to, it actually gets produced fairly often. And people kind of have to reconceptualize what it is. Like maybe the whole thing happens on a chessboard or maybe it's all in their mind or I don't know. But it just flopped horribly. 68 performances. It was a really expensive musical, but it lives in my heart every day. So I'm going to play for us right now one of the songs that was not in the original British concept recording, but was on the Broadway recording that is so outrageous. And it's a song called No Contest that that Freddie, the guy who sings Pity the Child, sings with his like manager. And it's like a bro, like misogynistic bro duet that is like so ABBA delicious. Well, you'll hear. Here it is.
Okay.
That's right. The lyric was, he lost it a woman and a half ago. That was the lyric that we just heard.
That
beautiful
is a lyric.
Two-part harmony.
Wait,
but
what's
I just
that?
Think that song is delicious.
Oh, that was. Yes. What's the other song from Chess that Anthony, you brought up Anthony Warlow last week, and he sings the absolute hell out of. The
Anthem.
Anthem. Yes, that song.
Anthem.
That's
Anthem
so good.
Is a song that you can sing at an audition and no one's ever mad at you.
Yeah, like, I think
it's
so.
Such a good freaking song. Yeah. And then I had once I had like I was taking a like an audition workshop and the guy gave me Pity the Child to sing and I was like, have you heard my voice? It's so freaky sky high. I don't know. I mean, maybe if I roll around to the ground and acted a little bit, but the music is amazing and they just keep trying. So Chess, come back one day when somebody figures out great score, terrible show, flop legend. Woohoo.
Oh, Chess. Woohoo.
Okay. Number two. This is big.
Okay. So number two.
Elaine Page.
Oh, Elaine Page. I always think of her when I think of Chess and that like crazy music video she made for it.
With the big hairspray hair.
Oh, so 80s. So this one, again, this is another one that I saw. So when I think Broadway flop, this is always the first one that pops into my head because I had so much fun at this play and it closed in three performances. I believe I'm saying that off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure that was the six regular performances. I'm so sorry. This is a play that starred Cheyenne Jackson, Henry Winkler, Ari Grainer, Jenny Barber, Alicia Silverstone, and Daniel Breaker. Great cast. It is called The Performers. It's by David West Reed and directed by Evan Cabinet. It opened in 2012. They claim that it closed because of Hurricane Sandy. It closed because the reviews were so mean. But it was one of the, I saw it in previews right before it opened, and it was one of the funniest plays I've ever seen. So The Performers is about a group of people at a porn convention. So, or like porn awards, I believe. So yeah, it's a romantic comedy set during the Adult Film Awards in Las Vegas. So it's Cheyenne Jackson and Ari Grainer play two huge porn stars who are getting awards. Henry Winkler is like the daddy of porn who's getting like a Lifetime Achievement Award. Jenny Barber played a couple of small roles, but her main thing was like the young upcoming porn star. And then Alicia Silverstone and Daniel Breaker, who Daniel Breaker, if you don't know, he was the original donkey in Shrek.
Yes.
Among many other things, but I think that might be one where most people know. They played like a couple who are there, as I recall, he's like a reporter reporting on it. Anyway, hilarity ensues because they're kind of a buttoned up couple at the porn convention. The couples get in big fights, but they all end up reconciling in the end. Jenny Barber, who played the character, her name was Sundown, as the up-and-coming porn star who had these giant fake breasts, was just like this Minnie Mousey character was so funny. But I'll just never forget, there's a great scene where like Ari Grainer and Cheyenne Jackson, who are the two big stars, are in their hotel room having this huge fight. And and like she's like, I'm pregnant, and he thinks she's been cheating on him. And Henry Winkler was hysterical as this sort of like granddaddy of porn type character in this like leisure suit. Like it, but basically all the critics were like, that was an unnecessarily long SNL sketch. And that is kind of what it felt like. Like the humor was okay. Very SNL sketch. Like imagine if SNL wrote a sketch, but then it became a full like 90 minute play.
It
was just crude joke after crude joke, but so funny. Yeah. Anyway, that's the performers. I'm very sad that it didn't have a longer run, but it was, especially Ari Grainer was like living her like Bette Midler dreams in the show. She had like red hair. Like imagine like young Bette Midler playing a porn star. It was so funny.
I don't even know, because I'm such a musical buff. I don't even like have a like grasp, I think, on, because plays do generally come and go much more quickly, especially if you've got big stars in it. It's usually a limited run of some kind. So good on you for keeping track of that. Although, and I hope I don't ruin this, if this is your number one, I really wanted to see The Last Confederate Widow.
Oh, which that's was not that my play, number one, but sure.
Which was that play with Ellen Burstyn. It was a play called The Last Confederate Widow. And it opened and closed on the same night.
Whoa.
But like it was a one woman play about, you know, and she must have like lived through the Civil War or something. But I just think Ellen Burstyn is so amazing. I go back to Requiem with a Dream, and she's just an unbelievably gifted actor. And it was the crash and burn of the century. Like,
yeah. Done. Like we haven't even talked about, I mean, it is easier to focus on the musicals. But there are some, like Patti LuPone did that one David Mamet play that opened and closed, and you're like, that should have worked and it didn't. And there was the Cherry Orchard revival with Diane Lane that was like rough, that they took place at a giant stump. Yeah, there have been a lot of kind of rough plays. I just think some of the musicals are just more
it's harder to get
about.
Audiences.
Because also
in.
Sometimes with the musicals, just because the show flops, sometimes we have the music that just keeps going, like Sideshow or Chess.
100%. Absolutely, yeah.
It's hard to use that in an audition.
Right. but try it out. Try it out and see how it goes for you and let us know.
Totally.
You know?
So that's my number two, The Performers, with Alicia Silverstone and many other wonderful people.
All right. 1988 is still happening.
Okay.
1988 is still happening as I come to my number two. My choice for number two, I think, is kind of widely regarded as the benchmark of Broadway musical flops. There have been documentaries based around it. There have been books about flops that have commented on it. Wow. So, of course, number two is Carrie the Musical.
I thought you were going to say Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace. I did see Amazing Grace.
Really?
I wish I hadn't. Yeah, I saw Amazing Grace. That was really fast.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so Carrie. Yes, you're right.
Carrie the Musical.
The most iconic flop of all time.
Iconic flop of all time.
Another one.
I bet you're wondering what my number one is now.
I know.
But Carrie,
so
1988
curious.
Lasted for five performances. It was very expensive. Written by Dean Pitchford, who also wrote Footloose.
Oh.
Let that wash over you. Music by Michael Gore. Out of town, Carrie's mother was played by, this is so wild because we all know Betty Buckley started this. Like Betty Buckley was the Carrie's mom, the religious fanatic. Mm-hmm. But out of town, it was Barbara Cook.
Whoa. That's cool casting. Whoa.
Darling, darling Barbara Cook.
I love that.
But Carrie, if you're not familiar and you need to get familiar, Carrie is based off a novel by Stephen King that became a famous movie with Sissy Spacek that they said, let's turn into a musical. So it's a horror musical about a teenager with telekinetic powers who is like constantly tormented in high school and gets a bucket of pig's blood dumped on her in her nice white dress because they're all being mean to her. And she goes nuts with her mind and kills everybody.
Basically,
which in turn leads her crazy religious fanatic mother to then murder her in the name of Jesus, which doesn't actually work. She stabs her, and then Carrie kills her with her kinetic powers in her mind. It's conceptually so wild that it was ever there, but it's
Betty Buckley starred as the mother, famously, which actually kind of did really well and has a great cast album that you could listen to. I think the girl who played Carrie is named Molly Ranson. And it starred Maren Mazie.
Yeah.
Maren Mazie was Crazy Mom in this. And then I want to say, I don't know, but it just seems like a role that Alice Ripley must have played at some point, or certainly should have.
I
think maybe
so.
She has.
Yeah.
But it's just the most legendary of all the flops. And they really tried to make it work. So let's listen to a little of the drama of Carrie the musical. Legendary. This is so wild. Listen up. This is Betty Buckley.
Oh, gotta love Betty Buckley.
God made Eve from Adam's rib, and Eve was weak. And Eve was weak. And I was weak. I prayed this day would never come. I should have known. I should have known. Now I am alone and so afraid. Oh Lord, I've seen this power before. The flesh is weak and I am lost. Father, don't forsake her. Father, take her. Cleanse her, purify her with the fire and the power and the glory forever and ever and ever.
It's just bonkers. The whole thing is bonkers and legendary. But yeah, entire books have been written about it. So research at your own peril. But Carrie the musical is my number two. What's your number one?
Okay, this is going to be kind of an unexpected one. Because I don't know if this isn't a flop. Like, and I probably should have chosen something like a Carrie, like a famous, like Amazing Grace, or, you know, one of those ones that was like full up. But this is just one that, like, this is when I was working at TKTS, one of my favorite shows I saw, and I'm sad that it's considered a flop because I think actually had a decent run, is SpongeBob SquarePants the musical.
Oh, I love the SpongeBob musical.
I saw SpongeBob 3 times.
Yeah, you did.
And the thing is, I am not a SpongeBob fan. Like, I've seen the show. Obviously, it has some very funny moments, but I'm not like a big SpongeBob SquarePants person. So I went into this musical being like, I don't know. I loved it because I think SpongeBob was one of the smartest shows I think I've ever seen. Props to Tina Landau, who directed it. Book by Kyle Jarrow, and then music by a lot of people, which should not have worked, and it did. Well done, Tom Kitt, for like pulling all of those songs together. But every song
it's
was
so
by a different like major person, and yet somehow they work. All the styles work for the characters that are singing them. The cast that opened was amazing. Everyone in that cast was just incredible. What I loved about that show, what I feel like was like an onion, and I don't like onions, but it was like, it was what you wanted it to be. And I think if you wanted just like a light, fun, silly musical, that's what it was. If you wanted a show that was like a hard statement on like the world as a whole and politics and climate change, it was that. If you just wanted fun songs, if you just wanted fun dancing, if you wanted like the coolest, craziest set of found materials you've ever seen, like that show was for literally everyone. You could be the biggest theater snob or the most sort of like base theater goer, and that, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in a way of like a person like my dad who's like, I just want to go have fun. Like, it will appeal to you. And I just feel like most people didn't give it a chance because it was SpongeBob. And I was working at TKTS at the time, and I remember it was at the Palace Theater. It was right in front of us with the big billboard. And so many tourists that would describe exactly what they wanted, and they would describe SpongeBob, and I'd be like, then you should go see SpongeBob. They'd all be like, no, I hate the TV show. Or like, I don't want to see a show based on a cartoon. And it's like, trust me, this show is genius, and it was the hardest sell I ever had while I was there.
That breaks my heart.
Yeah, and it broke. And then I felt bad. Like when it came to the Tonys, it was nominated for so many. It barely won anything up against The Band's Visit, which a great show as well. But there were just some things I was like, I feel like the Tony voters just didn't even bother to see it as well, which maybe that's a controversial thing to say. But
Slater should have won the Tony. that year.
Which show?
I'm Ethan Slater.
Oh, Ethan Slater. Should've they won. Said 80 Seconds Later. I was like, who?
Oh,
Ethan
seconds.
Slater was amazing.
Should have won the Tony over Tony Shalhoub.
I feel
I'm
like
sorry.
Even Tony Shalhoub was confused. He accepted it and he was like, what?
No. Yeah. That's just old people voting what's comfortable for them.
Yeah.
Never again will we see a performance quite like Ethan Slater
what he did.
In SpongeBob's. His yeah. skill set is outrageous. He's like a gymnast and a singer, and
But brought so much heart to that role. And Squidward, what's his name who played Squidward, who tap danced with 4 feet?
Yeah.
Who was the original in Mary Poppins?
Gavin.
It was. Anyway, I could go on for days about how much I love SpongeBob and how sad I am that it did not have a bigger splash on Broadway.
I am so with you. I'm SpongeBob obsessed. Can I tell you my SpongeBob story?
Please.
So they brought me to the UK because that's where they filmed. They ended up filming the musical like a pro shoot.
That's right.
Of the musical that aired on Nickelodeon and I think still does. And they flew me out to be the live audience taping host. So I we had 2 days of shooting with 500, 600 kids from schools in Plymouth, England, which is where I guess they left to go found Plymouth Rock.
Sure. Yes, exactly. That makes sense.
That's where that whole thing started. And I got pretty close to the cast and, to see them all get to come together again because they all believed in the show so much, and to hear Tina Landau giving speeches and just celebrating how great a show it is, because to listen to Tina Landau talk about it, it's chock full of meaning and nuance and legend and lore. And
it's such a smart show. Like, it was so
it is.
Anyway, sorry, keep going. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, shame on us all for not making SpongeBob a bigger hit on Broadway. I think it gets done a lot, but
I hope
SpongeBob forever.
Such a good production. So that's why that
what
is my number
one. What song
do
you
want
to hear?
Oh my God, that's right. I think we just go from the beginning, Bikini Bottom Day. I think that's how we kick it off.
I love it. I love it. Let's go. Somewhere there's a Krabby Patty that needs frying.
Bikini bottom, bikini bottom. Oh my God. Also, a fun, if you want to go down to YouTube Rebel, The Daddy Knows Best with the girl who played Pearl, just belting that theater down.
Jalen Josie.
Mama, can you hear me?
Yeah. Jalen Josie is her name.
Wackadoo. So good.
You are wise. I salute you.
Thank
on
you,
your
sir.
Number one. Shouldn't have been a flop. Yeah, my heart hurts for that one.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is crazy. For my number one, I kind of thought we would both at some point in our top 10 have to discuss. And I was dropping little nuggets about it. I thought for sure we would have to discuss Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. Because I think modern day legend, not since Carrie, has there been such a disaster in a literal sense, huge money, huge Julie Taymor, the U2, the tech, all of it. And it just was a disaster from beginning to ending. And I thought it should have been a Las Vegas spectacle.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what they were thinking.
Yeah, it was not a Broadway show, and they just kept trying to make it work, and people were ending their careers and getting hurt, but that's not my number one. I'm just surprised that we didn't talk about it.
Oh, see, I didn't pick it for number one because I assumed it was going to be on your list, and every time I've been waiting for it, and I was like, oh, it must be his number one, because I feel like financially speaking, that is the biggest Broadway flop in history, right? Didn't it lose?
Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's the record for the most expensive flop.
I think the budget on it was like nothing ever done before. I mean, the sets were outrageous. The costumes were outrageous. Yeah. The flying over the theater. I remember sitting in the theater and watching them fly above my head, but we had all heard about people
getting
falling
dropped
through the pit and getting bashed and broken. And so you're watching and you're like, I guess this is supposed to be cool, but I'm really just concerned for my safety.
Yeah. I saw it the day of Hurricane Sandy. I saw the matinee and then Hurricane Sandy hit that night. And I was like, well, this wasn't a very good day, was it? And I remember thinking, I was like, you know, if I die in this hurricane and the last thing I saw was Spider-Man, I'm going to be really bummed.
Really bummed about that. It's the old Sandy. It's the old Sandy Spider-Man 1-2 punch.
God, what a day. Well, anyway, what's your number one?
It's not my number one, but I thought we were going
to
do it.
We had
my number one is a lot like your number 10, where I'm doing a shout out to, ready for it, number one flop in my mind are Vampire musicals.
Oh,
all
point
of them.
Yes, you're right.
All of the vampire musicals.
Every single one.
Are flippity floppity. All right, let's go through it. 2001, Dracula the Musical, another Frank Wildhorn attempt. Weirdly enough, starred Kelly O'Hara. Did you know that?
I was
going
to say,
that's
it gave
fun
us Kelly O'Hara, though.
It gave us Kelly O'Hara. It ran for 157 performances, which I think we just have to give to the wild horn of it all, because 2001, we're still not that far off from Jekyll and Hyde. But Dracula did flop. I think that was...
Was that Michael Crawford?
No, I'm getting there.
Oh, okay.
Don't you fret. No.
Sorry, I'm mixing them up.
Don't
in
you
my
worry
head
about
there
that.
There are too many terrible vampire musicals.
I think this was Tom Hewitt.
Oh, it was
I think
Tom Hewitt.
Tom Hewitt was Tom Dracula, Hewitt, who I love Tom Hewitt.
So I remember Urban Broadway making fun of him. He was like, I'm Tom Hewitt and I'm Dracula now.
Oh, I've got my rage is going to come out. I'm going to Hulk out over the something here in a minute.
I can't wait.
So that was 2001, Dracula, 157 performances. Then in 2003, how could this not work? Elton John wrote Lestat, the musical, which also played at the Palace Theater, of course, based on Anne Rice's Lestat. And I love Interview with the Vampire, which was the, you know, Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt being homoerotic at each other.
I love it.
Lestat ran for a staggering 39 performances.
God, but did that have Carolee Carmello?
It sure did. It did have Carolee Carmello. And Carolee Carmello, will you look this up for me? Did Carolee Carmello get a Tony nomination from Lestat? Was she the single role?
I hope so. She's another one who deserves better.
She deserves better than to have been in Lestat and Scandalous. I know there was a song, one of those big songs in that was called The Crimson Kiss. But once again, Elton John can't even save vampire singing. Oh. And smack dab in the middle of those two disasters was Dance of the Vampires, which is... In its meager run of, what was it, like 60 performances or something? In its meager run, I happened to see it twice, including opening night.
Uh-huh.
I was obsessed with Dance of the Vampires because it was a huge hit in Europe, and I had been on tour in Europe, and it was like this huge, huge success, and I got hooked to the cast album, which was all in German, but I didn't care, because it's, once again, written by Jim Steinman.
Okay.
Who wrote all of the Meatloaf music. So it's all that huge bombastic rock and roll music.
Mm-hmm.
And was just a huge hit. And the original star of that in Vienna was the first big production, was Steve Barton, who was the original Raoul in Phantom.
Whoa. Okay.
So Michael Crawford, Sarah Brightman, and Steve Barton. Steve Barton was the lead vampire, Count von Krolok. In that his voice is unbelievable and the album. So it's just been this massive hit in Europe. And they, of course, we're going to bring it to Broadway. And I remember being at the opening night for Footloose. And of course, Jim Steinman was there because he had written Holding Out for a Hero. And I went up to him. I gathered all my strength and I'm like 20 years old. And I walked up to crazy Jim Steinman, who's had the long, crazy gray hair and always wore black gloves inside. And I was like, I just want you to know, I love Dance of the Vampires. And when you bring it to Broadway, I'm going to be in it. I said this to this man.
Wow. Good for
you. I said this to this man. And then I auditioned for the show because it was so much a part of me.
Uh-huh.
I auditioned for the show and I made it to the end twice when they were changing creative teams. And then I went in and sang my big song and Jim Steinman was behind the table. And didn't like my song, so he made me sing God Bless America a cappella, and then I did not book the show.
Interesting.
But what a bullet to dodge, because it was a disaster. So they brought in, why was it such a flop? Here we go. Because they brought in Michael Crawford, the original Phantom.
Yes.
Seems like a no-brainer. So they bring in Michael Crawford, they make it a huge star vehicle for him, and they completely changed the show and the tone of the show, which was the show had always been funny because it was based off a funny movie called The Fearless Vampire Hunters. It was kind of slapstick.
Uh-huh.
But it was also very, very dark, and the music really lent itself to the sensual darkness of it all. But Michael Crawford, in his contract, demanded full creative control over his character.
No.
And you can read all about this. He demanded full creative control over his character, and his people and he said that they would not do this if it was anything like Phantom.
Then why would you do it? Then why did he say
yes? Why do you think they hired you?
Yeah, like...
So they, like, some reports said that he was making $150 million.
What?
A week on it. It was spectacular, which he denied in the press. $150,000 a week.
Still, that's a lot of zeros for a Broadway contract when everybody else is making, you know, $25. So,
and apparently he absolutely tortured the cast, tortured the writers, because it ended up being where he had such control contractually over his character that he bulldozed everyone. The writers just felt like stenographers taking his notes down. So they tried to turn into this crazy armpit fart slapstick comedy, and it was horrifying.
And not in a good way.
Horrifying. Not in a good way. It should have been, he ruined it.
Oh.
His inclusion. And Jim Steinman stood behind him so solid, and he was like, he's worth every cent we're paying him. This is going to be the thing. But he was so... he was such an egomaniac and wanted to do it his way or no way that he tanked the production.
Wow.
And it was a huge, huge budget and went down in flames. But Mandy Gonzalez sang her ever-loving head off. Uh-huh. Max von Essen, who was also, I believe, in Lestat. So he's got two vampires to his name.
Okay.
were absolutely sensational in the show. But crashed and burned. So number one flops goes to Singing Vampires.
To Singing Vampires. It's why I have a signed Dance of the Vampires playbill because that someone gave to me as a gift. Because I keep all of my playbills. I'm that person.
Obviously.
And especially, you know, if they're signed or whatever. And at an auction, somebody bought me a family friend, like, I think it was a birthday gift. It was like, here's a signed Dance of the Vampires thing. It's like,
Happy birthday, Michael Crawford.
Yeah. So I never actually saw the show, but I have a signed playbill. I think at the auction probably went, you know, for like $37. Because at that point, the show was, you know, it had opened.
Gone.
So.
Yeah. Dance of the Vampires. What?
So but
why can't they do
musicals?
It? Doesn't it? It seems to me like vampires should be able to sing, right? They sing kind of singy.
And there's
but
something
no one can make it work.
Yeah, like it's sort of like Alice in Wonderland. They seem ones that should be no-brainers, or Britney Spears. Yeah. Like it's sort of in recap. I feel like a lot of these flops, you can see where the idea was. Somebody was like, "This is going to be great," and then for whatever reason, somewhere along the way, it's just not so great.
I highly recommend a listen to the German original Vienna cast recording. It's so wonderful musically, even though you won't know what they're saying. But we've got to listen to Mandy Gonzalez and Michael Crawford making their way through the Act One finisher, which of course was Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Oh, gosh.
Yep, that happened.
Wow. That's a thing that happened. Wow.
That's a thing. That's a thing that happened. That was fun. Flops are fun.
Flops are fun. And our first countdown together. Huzzah. We did it.
Huzzah.
Yay, team.
But you got to stay tuned because we are going to count down our honorable mentions. We're going to give you five more notable flops in our 15 through 11. But of course, you got to be a subscriber to get a hold of those. So make sure you follow us on socials, subscribe on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes. And of course, join us on Patreon.
Yes.
Because we're going to do those episodes are just for you. Early access to episodes, a welcome gift. And of course, monthly hangs with Juddy and myself and all of y'all. $5.
$5. Easy.
Who cares?
Oh my God. Maybe we can find more vampire musicals. If there are other vampire musicals that we missed, please leave
us
a review.
Let us know.
And we can read them like that. Or that's not how a vampire talks.
Well, that's what's got to be part of these of these hangs is we got to listen. You got to tell us your thoughts about your...
Yes. Your flow.
Your thoughts on our list.
Yeah.
And what your list would be.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's it for now.
Yes.
I'm Ben Cameron.
I'm Michael Judson Berry.
And we're theater nerds for life. And we love you, so get out there and see a show, darn it.
Go see it. Even if it's going to be a flop, I don't know. Go see it anyway.
Support the flops.
Support.
Justice for flops.
Support the flops.
Mark, quack, quack. Bye.
Bye.